Frank Muir goes into the law and investigates the humor of the profession with the help of Alfred Marx.
Two high court judges got drunk one evening and were arrested for disorderly behavior. So they agreed to judge each other's cases. The first judge came into court and pleaded guilty. "I sentence you to pay a 50 pence fine," said his friend, and then they changed places. The new accused also pleaded guilty. "I sentence you to 6 months in prison," said his friend. "Hey, but I only fined you 50 pence." "Yes," said the judge, "there's been too much of this sort of thing lately. This is the second case today."
Paddy O'Reilly, you are charged with being drunk and disorderly. What is your occupation?
Unemployed, Your Honor.
And how did you come to have money to buy drink?
I was treated by my friend Jock McTavish.
6 months for perjury. Is your name Arnold Smith?
It is, my lad.
And is your name Clifford Brown?
It is, my lad.
Arnold Smith, where do you live?
Now fixed abode.
And Clifford Brown, where do you live?
In the flat above him. A barrister was cross-examining the accused. "Tell me, what's big with four legs and a trunk?" The judge intervened. "That's irrelevant. Right first time, my lad."
Constable, what did the accused do?
She tried to pass off this pound note.
Counterfeit?
Yes, my lad, she had two. "I say, you, I want you to accompany me to the police station."
"Me? What for?"
"I'm terrified of going alone."
In this series of 8 programmes, we're going to have a look at the humour of various professions. As I hope you gathered from listening to the credits and from that little series of jokes, this week we're having a go at the law. Jokes about professions are usually of two sorts. Those which arise from within, which are often too specialised to be generally understood, and those which are made by people outside the profession. And these are usually based on fear. Nowhere is this truer than in the case of the law. Though it was set up to protect him, the man in the street views all the machinery of the law with grave suspicion and tries to keep clear of it. Justice is considered to be very expensive, and lawyers are proverbial for their extortionate fees. Let's go back to the Bible. St. Luke chapter 11, verse 52.
"Woe unto you, lawyers, for ye have taken away the key of knowledge. Ye entered not in yourselves, and them that were entering in ye hindered."
Dr. Johnson's attitude was quite clear.
"He did not care to speak ill of any man behind his back, but he believed the gentleman was an attorney."
And Oliver Goldsmith wrote,
"Laws grind the poor, and rich men rule the law."
Yes, it's the rich what gets the pleasure, and the poor what gets the blame once again.
Ain't it all a blooming shame?
When the poor feel particularly downtrodden, they tend to blame the injustice of the laws of the country. This common prejudice is expressed in Shakespeare's Henry VI, part two, it's after the commercial, when Dick the Butcher, one of Jack Cade's followers, outlines his plans for revolution.
"The first thing we'll do, let's kill all the lawyers."
Ooh. Now, inevitably, the law has overtones of guilt, and any mention of the law makes one hastily count one's sins, if any. There aren't many drivers who don't slow down when they see a police car, even though they're driving well within the speed limit. Police uniforms make us uneasy, and as usual, we convert this uneasiness into ridicule. It's with a great sense of relief that our guilt hears of the police making mistakes. Here's a report from the Edinburgh Evening Dispatch.
Two men arrested for trying to buy gold from a supposed black marketeer who turned out to be a police inspector have been released after proving that they too were police inspectors masquerading as black market operators.
Here are some police jokes from David Frost and John Cleese.
Excuse me, sir. Do you recognise this photograph? Yes, yes, I do. Rather good of me, don't you think? Charles Edward Fuller, I arrest you for the murder of Gladys Binks.
But I'm Henry Robinson.
Henry Robinson, I arrest you for the murder of Gladys Binks. It's very much the same, of course, when you actually try and beard the police on their own ground and go down to the police station. Good morning, Super.
Morning, wonderful.
It's strange, isn't it? It's very odd that though most people are extremely grateful for police protection, they still like to propagate the image of the policeman as plodding, slow-witted, always a few moves behind the clever criminals. I mean, take a case like the Great Train Robbery.
Who do you think may have perpetrated this awful crime?
We believe this to be the work of thieves.
I'll tell you why. The whole pattern is extremely reminiscent of past robberies where we have found thieves to be involved. The telltale loss of property, the snatching away of the money substances, it all points to thieves.
So you feel that thieves are responsible?
Well, heavens no, I feel that thieves are totally irresponsible. They're ghastly people who go around snatching your money.
I appreciate that, sir. Arthur.
You may appreciate that, but most people don't. If you like money snatched, you must be rather an odd fish, I think.
Who do you think is behind the criminals?
Well, we are, considerably. Catch up with the wretches.
Who do you think is the organizing genius behind the crime?
Oh, now, of course, you're asking me who the organizing genius behind the crime is.
You're a man of very acute perception, sir.
Well, let me say this. We think it's a Mindermast.
A Mindermast?
Yes, a Mindermast.
What exactly is a Mindermast?
Well, a Mindermast. A Mindermast is the code word we use at Scotland Yard to describe a mastermind. We don't like to use the word mastermind as that depresses the men to think they're up against that church. We call it a Mindermast. Futile endeavour to deceive ourselves, yes.
I see.
But we are using the wonderful equipment known as Identikit. Are you familiar with that?
I am, yes.
Familiar with the Identikit?
Yes, that's where you piece together the face of the criminal, isn't it?
Not entirely, no. We are only able to piece together the appearance of the face of the criminal. We can't actually piece the face together. I wish we could. I wish we could, because of course once you've captured the criminal face, the other criminal parts are not hard to find. The criminal body is situated directly beneath the criminal face, joined of course by the criminal neck. But through the wonderful system of the Identikit, or l'identikit as the French foppishly call it, through this system we have pieced together an extremely good likeness of the Archbishop of Canterbury.
So His Grace is your number one suspect.
Well, let me put it this way. His Grace is the man we're currently beating the living daylights out of.
And he's still your number one suspect.
No, I'm happy to say that the Archbishop, God bless him, no longer resembles the picture we built up. Changed, I think, for the better. He thinks for the worse. Difference of opinion.
I believe some of the stolen money has been recovered, isn't it?
Yes, it has.
What's happening to that?
We're spending that as quickly as we can. A short knife, but a merry one down at the yard. Good night.
Good night, sir.
Peter Cook and Alan Bennett, in a sketch which was written before any of the Great Train Robbers were popped into prison. The police are the first branch of the law that most of us come in touch with, but the police are only involved in a tiny part of it, its enforcement. There are many other branches of the law with other personnel, and it's impossible for the man in the street to avoid them all. For instance, if the man in the street wants to get out of the street and buy himself a house, then he's got to need a solicitor. For a definition of a solicitor, I refer, Your Honour, to the words of Sir Dingwall Bateson, President of the Law Society, 1952-3.
A solicitor is a man who calls in a person he doesn't know to sign a contract he hasn't seen, to buy property he doesn't want with money he hasn't got.
Of course, there are many other occasions when you've got to have a solicitor. You'd be unwise ever to go to court without consulting one, which is expensive, unless you get free legal aid. But even that can be problematical, as the old Daily Herald reported.
At King's Lynn, Norfolk, yesterday, a man was granted legal aid when he chose to go on trial on a charge of making a false statement for the purpose of obtaining free legal aid.
A solicitor, though apparently expensive, is often essential. He can even be quite friendly. He's your link with barristers and the law courts. He will stand up for you as his client. I mean, say you couldn't turn up to court one day.
At Middlesbrough Police Court yesterday, a solicitor asking for excuse from attendance of a client said, in the first place, he is a man of not very bright intellect, and secondly, he's employed on important government work.
That was from the Newcastle Journal. If you do get involved in legal proceedings, the next step after a solicitor could well be a barrister to defend your rights or your freedom in court. Jonathan Swift gave this definition of barristers.
A society of men bred up from their youth in the art of proving by words that white is black and black is white according as they are paid.
Most barristers in work are good. If they're not, they don't stay in work. But the atmosphere of the courtroom is not always tense and exciting. Not every case is like the last 5 minutes of Perry Mason. Occasionally, humour breaks through. For instance, there was the counsel cross-examining a rather scruffy, long-haired young man.
Mr. Smith, what are you?
A parrot.
A parrot? Do you make a living by it?
Yes, I keep the wolf from the door.
What, by reading your poems to him?
One can't help feeling that it's a bit easy for the barrister. The witness really has a chance to reply.
There was another case when a young barrister was defending a man on a charge of stealing a pair of trousers. Now, all the evidence seemed to be against his client, but the barrister pleaded with such skill and conviction that he had secured an acquittal. The court rose, and everyone except the defendant started to move out. It's all right, said the barrister. You're free. You can go now. If you don't mind, I'd rather wait till the prosecutor leaves the court. Why? Well, you see, I'm wearing the trousers.
Barristers don't have to worry about the justice of their client's cause. It's up to the judge to decide that. But what they have to do is to do their absolute best to present their client's case convincingly.
My name is Prevost Bertesby, and I am your counsel.
Good morning to you, sir, and a cup of the milk to you.
Good morning. I just want to ask you one or two questions, and I must emphasize that you must be completely frank with me.
Oh, yes, sir.
You see, I must be in possession of all the facts if I'm to go up into court and plead your innocence, so you must be frank with me.
Yes, sir.
I want to begin by asking you whether you, in fact, committed the crime of which you're accused.
Oh, yes, sir. I did, sir.
Ah. I don't think you can have understood me quite. You must be completely frank with me. There's no need to pretend that you committed the crime if, in point of fact, you didn't. Now, I'm going to ask you again, did you commit this offence?
No, sir.
I'm so glad you've come out into the open with me.
Right off my mind too, sir.
Good, good. Now then, you've been accused...
And wrongfully and wickedly accused, sir.
Wantonly accused, yes,
sir.
Of loitering with intent to commit a felony. Now then, Mr. Golightly...
Call me Fingers, sir.
Well then, Fingers.
Yes, sir.
Have you any idea what your defence is going to be?
Well, no, you didn't do it, sir.
Yes, well, I think we can afford to fill that out a little. It's not in itself a cast-iron defence.
But I didn't do it, sir. I didn't do it. I swear I didn't do it. And if I did it, may God strike me dead on the spot, sir.
Well, we'll just give him a moment, shall we? Good. Well, that's good. Unfortunate thing is, Fingers, is that though the fact that God has held his hand satisfies me, I doubt very much whether it's going to satisfy the judge. Now then, it appears that you were observed on the night of September the 12th loitering in a suspicious manner outside the residence of a widow, Mrs. Edith Coddington.
Well, sir, the point is, sir, that I wasn't loitering, sir. I was just doing my job, sir.
Oh, and what job is that?
Well, sir, I'm in business in a small way as a night repairer of bathroom windows, sir.
You see, seems a trifle specialized to a layman like myself. What are the advantages of being a night repairer?
Well, there's very little competition, sir, for one thing. And on the night in question, I was just doing a bit of freelance work outside of number 13 Scroggy Street.
Were you looking at the window or through it?
Oh, at it, sir. Oh, quite definitely. And in particular, sir, at the grouting of the window, sir. The shocking grouting of the window. Think to myself, what shocking grouting that is. Enough to aggravate a saint.
I see. Did you happen to notice, out of the corner of your eye, as it were, anybody come into the bathroom?
Well, sir, now you come to say it, I do vaguely remember someone coming in. But I remember thinking, what shocking grouting. Oh, what shocking grouting. Ah, here's the widow Coddington after having a bath. Oh, what shocking grouting.
Did you happen to notice what she was wearing, or failing that, what she was not wearing?
Well, as a matter of fact, I did, sir. Yes, sir, she was wearing Lyle stockings and some carpet slippers and a thick grey skirt and a green cardigan and a long, voluminous fur coat down to her ankle, sir. But that's all I can remember on the spur of the moment.
I see. So when she says, as she does in her statement, that she came into the bathroom clad only in her E-type knickers...
Down to the bottom of her black heart, sir. She's a mendacious woman, that Mrs. Coddington. She lies like a stair carpet, sir.
Well, I think that's all I want, Fingers, really. I shall, of course, try to discredit the character of Widow Coddington.
Yes, sir.
I notice she's got a Polish lodger, which in the eyes of the law is synonymous with moral laxity. It hasn't yet been made statutory. I shall, of course, try and get these E-type knickers brought into evidence.
And held against her, sir.
Exactly.
Alan Bennett and John Fortune. Now, let's assume that our unfortunate man in the street is still involved in the law. He's met police, solicitor and barrister, and now there are others he'll have to face in court. Because of the democratic nature of the English legal system, his fate will be decided by a jury. Now, a jury has been described as 11 men and one woman who spend 5 hours together in a locked room, come out and say, not guilty. A jury has also been described as 12 citizens who are chosen to decide which of the parties has the better barrister. But at least each individual can make his voice heard in the jury system. I remember seeing an old cartoon that showed the foreman of a jury peering out of the jury room door, looking extremely frustrated, and ordering 11 white coffees and one black, 11 biscuits and one donut, 11 bars of milk chocolate and one plain. Normally, you'll be glad to hear, all the jury members are private citizens chosen and sworn to hear evidence and pass their verdict. A lot of swearing goes on in the law courts.
Silence in court!
Take the book in your right hand and read what it says on the card.
Christmas time is here again. I wish you all, you wish yourself, and may your day be jolly.
The other side of the card.
I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Love, Dennis and Mabel.
Ronnie Barker and Terence Brady. The dominant figure, of course, in any court is the judge, and much of the humour in law centres round this august character. Let's hear some judge jokes. Alfred.
A scrap of a girl stepped daintily into the box during a county court case and was greeted with a friendly smile from the bench. How old are you? Asked His Honour.
10, sir.
And do you understand what an oath is?
Oh, yes, it's what father uses when he falls over the cat.
as the Lord is my judge, I am not guilty. He's not. I am. You are.
My lad, my lad, my lad. What is the maximum penalty for bigamy, my lad?
2 mothers-in-law.
Fortunately, it's very difficult to become a judge. So you don't get just anyone passing sentence on his fellow men. Many qualifications are required, including a knowledge of Latin.
Yes, I could have been a judge, but I never had the Latin. I just never had the Latin for the judging. I just never had it, so I'd had it as far as being a judge was concerned. I hadn't got enough of it to get through the rigorous judging exams. They're very rigorous, the judging exams. Very rigorous indeed. They're noted for their rigour. People come out of them saying, my God, what a rigorous exam. And so I become a miner instead. I managed to get through the mining exams. They're not very rigorous. There's no rigour involved, really. It's complete lack of rigour involved in the mining exams. They only ask you one question. They say, who are you? And I got 75% on that. It's not enough to keep the mind alive, is it? I sought solace in the printed page, quite frankly, for I'm very interested in the world of literature. But the trouble is that all this knowledge I've got hold of is useless. Useless as regards the judging. They require the Latin for it. I wish I'd had it, because it's safer work judging than mining. You're not troubled by falling coal, for one thing. You don't get that down your Guildhalls. It's a feature of your Guildhall life, the absence of falling coal. You get judges remarking on it. They say, hello, not much coal falling in today. And what's more, being a miner, as soon as you're too old and tired and ill and sick and stupid to do your job properly, you have to go. Well, the very opposite applies with the judges.
Peter Cook, sitting on a different sort of bench. Judges have to be very careful what they say in court, because they're often setting precedents for other cases. They choose their words very carefully.
The magistrate, Mr. Harley, said he thought it proper that at times a man should beat his wife, and the Bible supported that statement. But beating should be done as a service of love, not in temper. Accused should have used a reasonably sized stick. It was a pity he'd lost his temper and used an iron bar.
With the judge enthroned or embenched and all the machinery of the law on display, a courtroom can be a very impressive and dramatic scene. It is a very great standby for dramatists and film and television writers, and you can see why. The interplay between counsel and judge has a magic all its own.
My lord, in this case, my learned friend, Mr. Mel Travers, appears for the defence, and I appear for the money.
Oh, Mr. Mel Travers, I trust your leg is better.
I haven't hurt my leg, my lord.
I'm so glad to hear that. Please continue, Mr. Bartlett.
Thank you, my lord. The case would appear to be a simple one, my lord. The prosecution will endeavour to show that the snivelling, depraved, cowardly wretch whom you see cowering in the dock returned home on the night of the 14th of July in a particularly vicious and unpleasant frame of mind, had words with his wife, and then deliberately assaulted his pet ostrich by throwing a watering can at it.
A what?
A watering can, my lord, a large cylindrical tin-plated vessel with a perforated pouring piece much used by the lower classes for the purpose of artificially moistening the surface soil.
Thank you, Mr. Bartlett. Your knowledge is inexhaustible.
You are very gracious, my lord, if I may continue. The ostrich...
The what?
The ostrich, my lord, an ostrich, a large, hairy, flightless bird, resident in Africa, remarkable for its speed in running and much prized for its feathers.
A kind of cat.
No, my lord. The ostrich, taking flight, flew out of the window and landed on a passing ice cream cart.
Oh, there, what cart?
Ice cream cart, my lad. Ice cream, an artificial cream substitute, sweetened, flavoured and frozen, originally invented by the Mohican Indians as an antidote to trench foot.
Remarkable, remarkable.
Thank you, my lord, if I may be allowed to continue. I flew through the window and landed on a passing ice cream cart, thereby causing a small dollop of ice cream.
What?
A dollop!
I'm sorry, my lord, I was trying to clear my throat. thereby causing a small portion of ice cream to fall on the plaintiff, Mr. Sidney Buttle, a Methodist, who was hopping past at the time, thereby soiling his new suit. And those, quite simply, are the facts of the case, my lord. A very straightforward one, as I think we will all agree. It would appear, my lord, that the rule laid down in Pritchard against the East Halifax Fishbone Glue Manufacturing Company would apply.
John Cleese, David Hatch and Humphrey Barclay, in a sketch from Cambridge Circus, the university review that became the radio show. I'm sorry, I'll read that again. But after the legal wrangling in the courtroom comes the moment of truth, when the jury return to deliver their conclusion. Gentlemen of the jury, what is your verdict?
My lord, we are all of one mind. Insane.
After one or similar decision comes the sentence, the moment when there is silence, the camera pans nervously from accused to counsel to girlfriend in the public gallery. Then the judge pronounces, Patrick Sean O'Reilly, you have been found guilty of stealing a horse. This is a very serious offence. 70 years ago, it was a hanging matter.
Exactly. And 70 years from now, it mayn't be a crime at all. Why not postpone sentence for a while and see how things turn out?
Now over to that other famous hanging judge, John Cleese.
It is the verdict of this court that you be taken from here to a place of execution and there hanged by... Oh, I understand that you have been riding a bicycle without lights. You are fined 10 shillings. And may God have mercy on your soul.
The law, like the Mounties, is supposed to get its man. Though, of course, a lot of its work is not in the field of exciting crime. There are less dramatic cases where we are glad of the clarification that only trained legal minds can bring to an issue. An example from the Birmingham Post.
A submission that a pedestrian could not possibly be a vehicle was upheld by Wills and Magistrates yesterday.
And from the Daily Mail.
A motor horse box carrying a live horse can travel at 30 miles per hour. If the horse dies in transit, the vehicle immediately becomes a carrier of horse flesh and, by law, must reduce speed to 20 miles per hour.
We are indeed lucky to possess a legal system that makes that kind of distinction. In fact, we have an excellent legal system, but as I said earlier, its mysteries frighten most of us, and defensively we retain the prevailing image of lawyers as devious and rapacious. Let's hear an old epitaph.
Erected to the memory of Mr. Jonathan Gill, Esquire, who died February the 6th, 1751, aged 45 years and 6 months. Beneath this smooth stone, by the bone of his bone, sleeps Mr. Jonathan Gill. By lies, when alive, this attorney did thrive, and now that he's dead, he lies still.
You may applaud, but no doubt all the lawyers will cry unfair. Or probably, since they're lawyers, unjust. But their most humour is unjust. And next week we'll be doing justice or not to education. So until then, I leave you with this legal thought. Old lawyers never die. They're just called to a higher court. So until next week, from me and Alfred Marx, goodbye.
Bye.
Frank Muir Goes Into the Law was produced by Simon Brett and Bob Oliver Rogers.